Well, when last we left Joseph, he was being pretty successful avoiding the clutches of what person? Potiphar's wife. Mrs. Potiphar was determined to cause him to get involved in adultery with her. And she was after him, the text says, day after day after day. And he had a couple of strategies, and we spent a couple of weeks talking about those, but he had a couple of strategies that helped him. He rightly named what she wanted him to do as sin and a wicked thing. And so he understood what it was before him. He didn't try to make an illicit relationship beautiful. He called it sin. He called it a wicked thing. Secondly, he understood that to participate in this kind of sin was to sin not only against Mrs. Potiphar, not only against her husband, not only against himself, but ultimately to sin against God. And that was the second thing that he understood that helped him to maintain his purity. The third thing is that he avoided her. The text says he wouldn't even be around her. He did everything he could not to be around her. These things really helped him maintain his purity. Just as an aside, I hope, and we've tried to make the case over the last several weeks, that you and I need to sit down and determine what our strategies for purity are. And if you haven't done that, I'm begging you, I'm pleading with you to do that this week. To sit down and decide what are your strategies for maintaining purity in your life. Now today we come to the fourth strategy. This is what happens. Look with me at Genesis chapter 39 and verse 11. One day he went into the house to attend to his duties, and none of the household servants was inside. She caught him by his cloak and said, "Come to bed with me." But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. Now, it doesn't take a theological expert to figure out what the fourth strategy was for Joseph. What is it? Run! Run! Flee! Get out of there! Get out of the situation! When you and I are in situations, that tempting situations where temptation arises, it will not be good enough to name it what it is. It will not be good enough to think about who it is we're sinning against. It will not be good enough to think about and avoid the other person. We're going to have to do something else, and that is flee. When you are in the midst of temptation, it is not the time for us to have a theological discussion with the other person about purity. By the way, let me tell you what I heard in church a couple of weeks ago about the biblical theology of sex. Let's discuss it. No, that's not the time. That's the time to get out of there. That is the time to flee. That is the time to flee the situation. And that's exactly what Joseph does. He flees the situation. One writer said that he fled like a scared rabbit. Another writer said that he fled from Potiphar's wife like a scalded dog. Interesting pictures, right? The point is, he fled. When you and I get in those situations, when you and I get in situations where there is temptation, where there is difficulty, where we need to get out, that's what we've got to do. We've got to run. It's not a time for a theological discussion. It's not a time to share your strategy for purity. It is a time to run. To run. One writer said this, "Joseph was a man of impeccable character and integrity. The opportunity for indulgence merely brought out what was inside him." The opportunity for indulgence merely brought out what was inside him. Now, what happened? When she saw, verse 13, when she saw that he had left his cloak in her hand and had run out of the house, she called her household servants. "Look," she said to them, "this Hebrew has been brought to us to make sport of us." Now you notice she throws racism into the pot. "This Hebrew," and you can be sure she says it with disdain, "this Hebrew came into our house to make sport of us. He came in here to sleep with me, but I screamed. When he heard me scream for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house." Now, I want you to know something. Even though things aren't going to turn out so well for Joseph, you know the story. You've heard it enough. If you grew up in a Christian home, your parents told you the Genesis account. You heard it 100 times in Sunday school because Sunday school writers, curriculum writers, just seem to love to camp on a couple of Old Testament passages. And it is a good passage, but even though he maintains his integrity and his purity, he winds up in a world of hurt. And that's going to raise some questions we'll deal with in just a few moments. But one thing I want to notice right now, and I think this is so important, and it's so important for our young people to understand. One writer said about Joseph, young in life and away from home restraints. By the way, if you were putting that in contemporary terms, young in life and away from home restraints, who would we be talking about? Some college students? Who else? How many of you who are new to the Air Force are away from home? Away from home restraints. Not just college students. College students are some. Students, if you're in the public system and you participate, for instance, in UIL competitions here in Del Rio, you travel every weekend by bus to places like San Antonio or Laredo or Kerrville, and you're away from your parents. We lived through that one. Young in life and away from home restraints. That's a lot of young people. Joseph must be highly admired for this fine behavior in a tempting, difficult situation. He succeeds in maintaining his purity. He succeeds in maintaining his purity, but it brings with it a cost. Verse 18, she kept his cloak beside her until his master came home. Then she told him this story. That Hebrew, there's that racism again, that Hebrew slave you brought us came to me to make sport of me, but as soon as I screamed for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house. That's a bold-faced lie. That's not what happened. That's not what happened at all. He had to run out to flee her advances, and she lies to her husband. And we see his response in verse 19. When his master heard the story, his wife told him, saying, "This is how your slave treated me." He burned with anger. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. He maintained his purity. He maintained his integrity. He maintained his faith in God and his walk with God. And it landed him where? Right in prison. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm thinking to myself, if I'm Joseph, I'm saying to myself at this point, my life is snake bit. At 17 years old, I am sold into slavery. Thankfully, my brothers decided against killing me. But I'm sold into slavery, and at 17 years old, I'm taken far away from home to another land. And there I work hard, I keep my nose clean and to the grindstone, and what happens to me? I rise up to the top of the house. My life isn't what I would like it to be, but it's not what it used to be. And now this. And he winds up in a prison, a place that he calls, the text describes as a dungeon in chapter 40. Literally in Hebrew, it means a hole. What this place was, this prison that Joseph is placed in, was a place below ground. It was a big, one gigantic room, and it only had a little grate at the top for light to stream in and for relatives of the inmates to come and drop a little bit of food to their relative. It was dank. It was dark. It was smelly. You can't even imagine the unsanitary conditions of a place like that. Joseph maintained his purity. He maintained his faith. He maintained his integrity and winds up in this awful place. One writer said it this way, Joseph shares a sense of destiny with his family and it gets him a pit and a ride to Egypt. He is committed to being morally pure and it lands him in jail. What is to be made of these paradoxes? How are you and I to understand these things? How are we to understand that happening to God's people? How are we to understand that happening to righteous people who are trying to live righteously? You can almost hear somebody saying, it wasn't Joseph, but you can almost hear somebody saying, it's not fair. It's not fair. Have you ever felt that about life? Have you ever felt that about something that's happened in your life? Some way you've been overlooked, some way you've been mistreated, some way you've been falsely accused, and you say, I'm trying to live a righteous life, I'm trying to walk with the Lord, I'm trying to live by faith. It's not fair. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but I'd be willing to bet that almost all of us have been there sometime where we have said, it's not fair. And the problem with that is soon it's not fair becomes God's not fair. We face the hurts of life, the failures of life, the injustices of life, the mistreatment of life, the disappointments of life, and we say it's not fair. But the amazing truth is expressed by one writer who said this, God wraps them, that is the hurts, the failures, the disappointments, the injustice, God wraps them in His purposes and changes them. You see, that is what I think Joseph believed, and that is what maintained him through all of these ups and downs of his life. And that is the only thing that's going to maintain you and maintain me through the ups and downs of life, is to remember that God can wrap those disappointments in His purposes. He can wrap those injustices in His purposes. He can wrap that mistreatment in His purposes, and He can change them. You see, there are only two ways to deal with these things in our lives. There's only two ways that you can deal with the disappointments that may have already come into your life or will come into your life. There's only two ways to respond. The first way is that we can become consumed by them. We can become bitter, eaten up inside, never letting go of the hurt. And we become bitter and we become consumed with revenge against those who hurt us. But you know what? As we study Genesis 39 and 40 and we look at Joseph's response, we don't see him spending any time thinking about what a rat Potiphar's wife is and how foolish her husband was to believe her. See, one way to deal with disappointment is to be consumed by it, to become bitter, to become eaten up inside, never letting it go. And you become so turned inward that you can't even hear the pain of the people around you. The second way we can respond is the way Joseph did, and that is we can see beyond the hurt, the pain, the disappointment, and allow God to use those things to fulfill His purposes for us. That's the glorious thing about being a Christian. That's the glorious thing about being in a relationship with Jesus Christ. He has a purpose for you and a purpose for me. And no matter what we endure, no matter what we go through, no matter what we face, no matter what disappointment, He can turn it to His purposes. What a great truth. What an encouraging truth. Charles Swindoll said these words, "Our human ways are based on what seems fair. We firmly believe that when someone does what is right, rewards and blessings result. When someone does what is wrong, there are serious consequences, even punishment. But that's our way, not necessarily God's way, at least not immediately. God's been known to allow unfair treatment to occur in the lives of some absolutely innocent folks for reasons far more profound and deep than they or we could have imagined." How slowly He steps in. It's not fair. How do you survive the it's not fairs of life? That's what we're going to spend the rest of our time this morning talking about. Now, by the way, in studying this, I've come to understand one thing. I'm going to share some ideas with you at the end of our time together this morning. But one thing I want to share with you right now. I've come to understand, as I've studied the lives of the patriarchs, and I've come to understand, especially as I study the life of Joseph, that when you don't understand how God is dealing with you, and when you and I don't understand why life seems unfair, we are probably being prepared for greater things. Let me say that again because I think it's important. When you and I don't understand God's dealing in our lives, when we face things that seem unfair, we are probably being prepared for greater things than we can imagine. I don't have time, but you could go through so many biblical examples. Just think, just for one moment, think about Moses. Moses, adopted into Pharaoh's family, is raised in all of the advantages of being in Pharaoh's family, taken, adopted by his daughter, and being raised in all those advantages, and at 40 years old finds himself fleeing to the desert, where he listened for the next 40 years to nothing but the bleating of sheep. Little knowing that in that time, you see, the New Testament gives us some light on what he was thinking. He was thinking it's time. He began to understand he was the deliverer of his people Israel. And he was thinking it's time to get with the program and let's deliver the people. And so he kills the Egyptian who is harassing one of the Hebrews. And the next thing he knows, he's on a fast camel caravan out of Egypt. And for 40 years, he listened to the bleating of sheep, which gave him a whole lot of training in what he would have to do for the next 40 years of his life, listening to the bleating sheep of Israel. I wonder how many times in those 40 years he said to himself, "What am I doing in this desert? How was I so foolish to think that God wanted to use me to deliver his people?" Well, God did want to use him to deliver his people, but he had some things to do in Moses' life first, and it took the desert to do that. What's he preparing you for today? What disappointment are you facing today? What injustice do you feel in your life today? He will use that in your life to prepare you for something even better than you can imagine. Well, verse 19, when his master heard the story, his wife told him, saying, "This is how your slave treated me." He burned with anger. Joseph's master took him, put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. But while Joseph was there in the prison, now this is the marvelous thing. This is the incredible thing. He winds up in prison. You know, what a yo-yo life, up and down and up and down. He winds up in prison, but look what happened. While Joseph was there in prison, you got to underline the next phrase. The Lord was with him. The Lord was with him. The Lord was with him. That's the third time in this passage that we're told that the Lord was with Joseph. He showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. I want you to understand this. I want you to think about this. There is no place you can go where God is not with you. If you love him, if you are walking with him, there is no place you can get away from him. Even when you want to walk away from him, he's there. The way Jonah wanted to do. God said to Jonah, "You know what? I want you to go to the east and I want you to save the enemies of my people Israel." And Jonah says, "That's not a great idea. I hate those people. Why would I want to see them saved?" Thank goodness none of us feel like that today, right? And so he heads west. And God says it sends a storm and a fish. He said, "You know what? Your accommodations on that ship are about to get better. You're going in the water. And I'm going to give you a fish to take you where I want you to go." And I always laugh when I read that text. It says the fish vomited him up on shore. I think, well, what an inglorious thing to happen to a prophet. The Lord was with him. There's no place. Whatever the darkest, scariest thing of your life is, God is with you. God is with you. God showed him kindness, granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. So the warden, now get this, look at this. So the warden put Joseph in charge of all those held in the prison, and he was made responsible for all that was done there. The warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care because what? The Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. Wow. There's that yo-yo again. He rises to the top. And even as we read under Potiphar, he had no cares. Potiphar had no cares in the world except the food on his table. Now we read that the warden puts everything under Joseph's care so that he didn't worry about anything. How did that happen? The Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. One writer said this, "Even in prison, Joseph is productive and is quickly given authority." You know, we'll say more about this in a few minutes, but anybody willing to work, anybody willing to do even the nastiest duties and do it conscientiously and do it as unto the Lord, and we really talked about this 3 or 4 weeks ago, but anybody who is willing to do that is going to be elevated. So don't you be the worst person in your flight or the worst person in your job or the worst person in your school. Don't be that person. Don't be the one always trying to get out of work or the one always doing things in a haphazard, slipshod way. Don't be that person. Let somebody else be that person. You're not that person. You belong to the living God. Act like it. I belong to the living God. I must act like it. Well, sometime later, now chapter 40, when you see words like that, You say, what is this? Sometime later. How long a time are we talking about? Well, we know that Joseph is 17 when he's sold into slavery. We know that he's 30 when he's elevated to the second in command to Pharaoh in all of Egypt. So in that 13-year time span, Joseph has been a slave in the house of Potiphar. He has been imprisoned. And then finally, after 13 years of all of that, he is elevated to second in the land. So we don't know how much time went by. We don't know how much time he spent as a slave, how much time in prison. But sometime later, the cupbearer and baker of the king of Egypt offended their master, the king of Egypt. Pharaoh was so angry with his two officials, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, and put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard in the same prison where Joseph was confined. The captain of the guard assigned them to Joseph, and he attended them. Now, I want you to understand this. The chief cupbearer and chief baker, what are they? You know, what are we talking about? Do we have cupbearers today? We have bakers today. I love bakeries. I love walking in and the aroma. It's just wonderful. We know what a baker is, right? But what is a chief cupbearer? And your text may even say a butler. That's really way out there in left field. He wasn't a butler. What the chief, by the way, these were two really important officials to Pharaoh. And the reason that they were really important officials to Pharaoh and to any king is because they dealt with what? Food. If you wanted to kill a king, one of the easiest ways to do it would be to what? Poison his food. So these two guys weren't just, you know, weren't just some baker out there somewhere. Wasn't just some butler somewhere. These people became confidants to the king that they were serving. Especially the cupbearer. They became confidants to them. And of course, the cupbearer, his job was twofold. One is he would taste the wine or food that his king was to eat. One reason was to make sure it was up to snuff, make sure it was good stuff. He was a food critic par excellence. He didn't have a column in the San Antonio Express News, but he had authority. And he made sure the king's wine and the king's food was great. Secondly, and most importantly, he tasted the wine and tasted the food to make sure there was no poison in it. That's a pretty important job, don't you think? And because of its importance and because of how close they became to the king, to the Pharaoh, in other kingdoms as well, cupbearers were extremely important. If you want to see a biblical example of that, read the first couple of chapters of Nehemiah. He was a cupbearer. It was an important job, and the baker was an important job because both dealt with food. Well, something offended Pharaoh. We're never told in the text what it is. We don't know. It could have been something important, something really big, like he thought that they were conspiring against him and perhaps going to seek to poison him. Or it could have been something as simple as that was a really rotten meal. Off to jail. I never want you to make tuna noodle casserole for me again. Okay? Let me try to say that again. Tuna noodle casserole. It's going to spit it out there. Okay. Well, the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt offended their master, the king of Egypt, and they find themselves in prison. I have so many things I come across when I study that it's just so fascinating to me, and I wish I could include all of them, and I do have a limited time on Sunday morning, even though you may not think I do, but I do. And I ran across some fascinating things about bakers in that day. They weren't just baking bread. I mean, there were like 57 varieties of bread they would bake in that day. Isn't that fascinating? Well, it was to me. Okay. The captain of the guard assigns them to Joseph, and he attended them. After they had been in custody for some time, each of the two men, the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were being held in prison, had a dream the same night, and each dream had a meaning of its own. So they're in prison for some time. Joseph is ministering to them, and they each have a dream, and they don't understand the dream. Now, see, when they had access to the palace, there were all kinds of people in that day whose job was to interpret dreams. Kings would keep a whole guild of dream interpreters around to tell them what dreams meant and to try to tell them what the future might hold. But these two had nobody there. At least they thought they had nobody. Verse 6, when Joseph came to them the next morning, he saw that they were dejected, so he asked Pharaoh's officials who were in custody with him in his master's house, why are your faces so sad today? Now I want you to understand something again. I want you to see something so important. If Joseph had turned to self-pity, when he wound up in prison after trying to do the right thing, after maintaining his moral integrity and his purity, and he winds up in prison, if he had turned inward, if he had gone to self-pity, if he had gone to the woe is me attitude, what would have happened to him? He would have been so turned inward that he couldn't think about or care about anybody else. That's what's wrong with doing that in your life and in my life. You are going to, as a matter of being creatures in a fallen world, you're going to be mistreated by somebody. You're going to experience disappointment. You're going to experience injustice. But if you turn inward and play the woe is me, pity me party, you're no good to the people around you. Joseph didn't do that, and so when Joseph came to them the next morning, he saw that they were dejected. You see, he could look outwardly. He could look at the people around him. He could sense and feel and identify with the pain of the people around him. See, that's one of the most basic things that pain does for us, is gives us empathy with those around us in pain, if we respond rightly. If we respond with self-pity, it won't do that. But if we respond rightly, with the right attitude, it will help us to be sensitive to the pain of the people around us. And Joseph was, so he asked Pharaoh's officials who were in custody with him in the master's house, why are your faces so sad today? We both had dreams, they answered, but there is no one to interpret them. Then Joseph said to them, and now we see Joseph's humility, he still maintains humility here. Joseph said to them, in fact, he may have learned humility through all that happened to him. Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell me your dreams. In other words, God's the only one that can interpret dreams rightly. And he may reveal to me, because Joseph has had those experiences early in his life where he had a couple of dreams and the meaning was revealed to him. So he acknowledges God, interpretations belong to God. And he says, tell me your dreams. So the chief cupbearer told Joseph his dream. He said to him, in my dream I saw a vine in front of me, and on the vine were three branches. As soon as it budded, it blossomed, and its clusters ripened into grapes. Pharaoh's cup was in my hand. I took the grapes, squeezed them into Pharaoh's cups, and put the cup in his hand. Now, you and I know the end of the story, right? We've heard this so many times. We know what the dream means. But I want you to kind of wipe all that away and think about Joseph. He's just being faced with some facts here. Something to do with three branches, something to do with squeezing grapes into a cup and giving them to Pharaoh. So God has to give him the interpretation. And so he does. This is what it means, Joseph said, verse 12. Said to him, the three branches are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your position, and you will put Pharaoh's cup in his hand just as you used to when you were his cupbearer. And then Joseph throws in a word for himself. But when all goes well with you, remember me and show me kindness. Mention me to Pharaoh and get me out of this prison, for I was forcibly carried off from the land of the Hebrews, and even here I have done nothing to deserve being put in a hole, literally a hole, a dungeon. So he puts in a word for himself. Well, the chief baker is listening into all this, and his dream had some same elements as the cupbearer's dream. There's a three in it, and he's got bread on his head for Pharaoh. So he's thinking, hey, wow, this is really good. The cupbearer got a good interpretation. I'm going to find out what my dream meant. When the chief baker saw that Joseph had given a favorable interpretation, he said to Joseph, I too had a dream. On my head were three baskets of bread. In the top basket were all kinds of baked goods for Pharaoh, but the birds were eating them out of the basket on my head. Now, Joseph's an honest man, so he's going to give him the honest interpretation. I don't know that I'd have this kind of guts as Joseph. This is what it means, Joseph said. The three baskets are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift off your head. You notice that's a little preposition, but makes a lot of difference. Lift up your head, as with the chief cupbearer, or lift off your head. There's a world of difference in those two prepositions. 3 days Pharaoh will lift off your head and hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat away your flesh. Boy, he thinks he was dejected before. Now the third day was Pharaoh's birthday, and he gave a feast for all his officials. He lifted up the heads of the chief cupbearer and the chief baker in the presence of his officials. He restored the chief cupbearer to his position so that he once again put the cup into Pharaoh's hand, but he hanged the chief baker just as Joseph had said to them in his interpretation. Now I want you to underline the last verse of that chapter. The chief cupbearer, however, did not remember Joseph. He forgot him. Now I'm saying to myself, wait a second. My memory's not what it once was, but I can remember something that important for 3 days. Right? 3 days! He's restored to his position 3 days, and he forgets Joseph. Now if you really want, I want you to see a couple of things here. Number one, who is it that didn't forget Joseph when he was there? God. Four times in chapter 39, we're told God was with Joseph. You see, that's why you depend upon God. That's why your hope is in God, not man. For 3 days, the guy couldn't remember that Joseph helped him out of a tight spot. But God hadn't forgotten him. But verse 1 of chapter 41 gives us the full import here. When 2 full years had passed, you see, it was 2 years between the time that the cupbearer was released and the time that he remembered what Joseph did for him. For 2 more years, Joseph had to be in that hole in the ground. For 2 more years. Now, what can we learn from Joseph about responding to unfair treatment? Let me take a few more minutes and I want to talk about that. How can we respond to unfair treatment? First thing I want to deal with is Dr. Swindoll mentions four categories that unfair treatment falls into. Four categories. There are many forms of unfair treatment in your life and in my life, but they can all be kind of categorized under four categories. The first is this. There will be undeserved treatment from family. Undeserved treatment from family. Many people have difficulty with their families. Many people come from families where there was favoritism or where there was abuse. Come from families where there's a broken home. Many people find that disappointment, find that unfair, unjust treatment from family. The second category, I'm quoting here, second category is the unexpected restrictions of circumstances. And what Swindoll means by that is that when you or I are confined either physically or emotionally in some way. Joseph was confined physically to prison. Some people are confined to their home or to a bed because of illness, whether it be emotional illness or be physical illness. Some people are confined and they can't move about. And that's a place sometimes, a source of unfair treatment. Some people are confined emotionally. Though they function, they're emotionally confined. The third category of unjust or unfair treatment are untrue accusations, people saying false things about you. If you haven't yet had that happen in your life, get ready. For whatever reason, people will say unfair or false things about you, and that will be a source of unfair treatment. The fourth area, real quickly, is unfair abandonment. That is being left behind by a husband or a wife or a friend or an employer. Somebody you depended on, somebody you trusted, somebody you looked to, and you're left behind by them. And that's another source of unjust treatment, another source of disappointment, whether it be adultery, whether it be abandonment by an unbelieving spouse, whether it be an employer who uses you and it throws you away with the garbage. All right, so what do we do about it? Let me give you a couple of ideas. Number one, from the life of Joseph. Number one, when you find yourself a victim of unfair circumstances, when you find yourself disappointed, when you find yourself ready to play the blame game, the first thing you and I need to do is do what's at hand and do it well. Be conscientious. What do I mean by that? Joseph is sent into prison, and what does he do? He immediately begins to work in the prison to the point that he worked his way up to be the guy in charge. Do what's at hand. Have a positive attitude. Have an attitude of expectation in your life. You are a child of God. Have an attitude of expectation. God can turn this situation. So do what's at hand. Do it well. Be conscientious. Keep a positive attitude. Joseph could not have seen how being in prison could be helpful to his release. The second thing we need to do on the example of Joseph is to stay busy. Make yourself available to God. Stay busy. You see, when you're not busy, you have a tendency and you're prone to think about yourself and your problems and your difficulties. When you're busy, you let your mind go to other things. So keep busy. Keep busy, even if it's busy at menial things. I can't imagine what Joseph must have had to do in that prison, in those circumstances. Number three, if you're going to deal with the unjust hurt you feel in your life, you've got to be sensitive to the hurting people around you. I've got to be sensitive to the hurting people around us. That's one of the just basic things that hurt does to us, is helps us to have radar to feel other people's pain. To understand how much that hurts. Be sensitive to the hurting people around us. If Joseph had been locked in self-pity, he would never have been sensitive to the plight of the cupbearer and the baker. Number four, when opportunity comes up, don't just stay silent. Trusting God does not mean we do nothing. You see, Joseph had an opportunity. He explained the cupbearer's dream. He believed that God had given him the interpretation, which meant the cupbearer would be restored to his place. So Joseph took the opportunity to say, you know what? I'm in here unjustly. When you're restored, get me out. He could have said, you know what? I'm not going to say anything because I prayed about it. I'm sure he prayed about it many times. But when the opportunity came, he didn't just stay silent. Please remember this, trusting God does not mean doing nothing. For so many of us, that's what we take it to mean. Number five, most of all, make God the focus of your life. Make God the focus of your life. That'll also help you not to focus and help me not to focus on myself and get locked in self-pity. Number six, a dirty word. It's a four-letter word. Sorry, don't mean to use four-letter words on Sunday. But number six, you have to wait. Joseph had to wait 2 full years before good came out of his situation. So much we could say. Suffering, one writer said this, suffering helped to make a man of Joseph. The suffering was not enjoyable, but it was necessary, and one day it turned into glory for Joseph. One day it turned into glory. Let me leave you with one last thought. Eugene Peterson said this, all the water in the ocean cannot sink a ship unless it gets inside the ship. And all the trouble in the world cannot harm you and cannot harm me unless it gains entrance to our hearts. So what do they do to keep a ship from taking on water? They caulk it. They pitch. They put pitch on the outside of the ship. Why? It keeps it from taking on water because it can't sink unless it takes water inside. You see, the pitch for your life and the caulk for your life and my life is faith. Is faith. And the water of adversity and the water of disappointment and the water of unjust treatment can't get inside your life if you've pitched and caulked your life with faith. Let's bow together in prayer. Father, thank you for the example of your servant. Thank you for reminding us, as the song we sang earlier says, you never let go. Others may forget us, but you are always with us in the darkest corners of our lives. Help us to remember that. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.